You're listening to Against the Grain, and today we're talking about the wave of militancy and revolt in the 1960s and 70s. No, not by the student movement, but by the working class throughout the United States during that period, a story that has not been often told, and a new book attempts to do that. It's called Rebel Rank and File, Labor Militancy and Revolt from Below During the Long 1970s, edited by Aaron Brenner, Robert Brenner, and Cal Winslow, who joins me in studio. And one of the contributors is Mike Hamlin, who was one of the founders of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And just before the break, Mike, you were describing how the League of Revolutionary Black Workers was born and how the model of black workers electrified not only other workers in the area, but really electrified people around the country, both black and white, and for many on the left seemed like the most promising direction for some sort of anti-capitalist organizing. What were the obstacles that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers ended up facing? What was the fate of the organization?
Well, of course, you know, we were high on the COINTELPRO list, and let me just say, and this is true, this is why it's so difficult. It's a very difficult thing to go against the grain, like you're saying. What I feel we did, we had a number of significant accomplishments, major accomplishments, because, you know, we got into the legal arena with Ken Cockrell and that aspect, a component of the league. The experience, it was far-reaching and far-broad. We organized a number of unions that, most of them have joined larger organizations. Now, like, we organized the Welfare Workers Union in Detroit. We organized the secretaries at Wayne State and various places around, all across the country.
So, given those accomplishments that the movement was able to achieve, what were the eventual obstacles to keep building and expanding?
Few people in an organization like this generally are the ones who do the work and take the risk, and both are enormous. There's, many of us, you know, lost spouses and, jobs and whatever else we had, and sleep. And, you know, and so it's harder than working in any factory. So it takes a toll on you. It's also dangerous. We had people shot and killed in our office from across the street on the roof. A man who was organizing tenants, started the first tenant organizing in Detroit. We gave him office space in our office, and he was shot and killed. We were continually on the street and at our houses confronted with the FBI, the state police, coming up, just letting us know they were around, wanting to know what we were talking about, if we would talk to them. And no doubt they had people within our ranks, infiltrated within our ranks. Some people just got tired and they want to do something else, and they don't necessarily want to be honest and say, I'm going to quit because I don't. I mean, they begin to find fault. You get into these sectarian fights, and ultimately, we saw then it began to fall apart, and we got hooked up with James Fullman, the people from SNCC. We introduced the Black Manifesto. We had published some books. We had made the film, finally got the news. But the core of the organization, a number of the people just they had had enough and they just walked away. I want to emphasize again, and I believe that this is the question for people who wonder where the working class is now. There is the potential there, I believe, for organizing, but you have somebody. You have, first of all, you have to have an analysis, a correct analysis of the reality of these workers and where they need to go. You have to be willing to work harder than anybody else. There are certain things if you say or do, this system will come down on you. And one of the things that I say, I think that sums up where we are, I actively participated in the anti-war movement, which was uncommon for blacks in that period. But by the time the war ended in Vietnam, we didn't, and that includes both blacks and white radicals from that period, as far as I know, we were not even together enough to be able to celebrate that victory. And that was because we had been expended and exhausted in the process of what we were doing. We gave it all, and it took all that we had.
And, of course, social movements do have a life cycle as well. One of the things, Cal Winslow, that is remarkable about the militancy that is documented in this book, Rebel Rank and File, is that the union upsurge of this period from roughly the mid-60s to the early 1980s came in waves, and came in waves that perhaps had it come at the same time might have been more helpful strategically for the movement as a whole. But while things were tailing off in Detroit, then they picked up elsewhere. Can you give us a sense of those waves and how it affected the movement?
Well, sure. For one thing, we tried to understand what was going on in the economy, because after what for many people had been a long period of prosperity, the 50s is still known and for in its own way prosperity, economic crisis returned, and recessions and depressions were said to be a thing of the past, but they returned in the 70s, in 70, again in 74, again in, you know, at the end of the decade, and so that meant that the conditions, economic conditions, changed wildly. So that, speaking again, sorry, Mike, I hope you don't mind this, but as for an auto worker, one day you're working more than you could possibly want to, forced to work overtime, forced to work weekends, and the next day you're out of work and you don't know when you're going to be back. So that made for the kind of waves, I think, that you're talking about. Then the movement tended to develop along industrial lines, and not in a pattern of not in a unified way. So the miners' movement really culminated in the middle of the 1970s, when in three summers running there were waves of wildcat strikes. I think more than 9,000 altogether. 99% of them wildcat strikes. The teachers' strikes lasted right steadily right throughout the decade. First in response to wanting to organize, then in response to the fiscal crisis of the later 1970s. So the farm workers' movement had begun in the 1960s and went right through the decade, culminating in part in a big strike in the California in 1979. So there seems to be a unity looking at it from a distance. In fact, there were problems time-wise. And the other thing, of course, is that the student movement kind of came to an end in the very early 70s. The Black Power movement was the victim in the early 70s of savage repression right throughout the country. The women's movement in its radical phase, I think, kind of started to decline in the middle of the 1970s. So nothing is really kind of going along. There's no harmony in the wider movement. Secondly, I think the United States and our geography, as well as our history, played a role. And to put it this way, think about the groups, the centers of militants that we think of, the urban city centers where black workers lived, Appalachia, where the coal miners were concentrated, the California valleys, far removed from the cities, often, you know, New York City and its own, always its own kind of a world as a center for militancy. So the movement wasn't really able to be united in the way it might have been because of history and because of geography. And the movement, in a national sense or in a class sense, didn't really produce a clear mission that was widely agreed upon, or a clear political agenda. It didn't produce nationally recognized leaders. And that fragmentation, I think, was a great weakness of this movement.
So while there was, as you say, Cal, no coordinated effort or no very effective coordinated effort that went on between these disparate movements, obviously you did have a nationwide union bureaucracy, which so many of these movements were reacting against. As you say, so many of these strikes were in fact wildcat strikes in defiance of the union. You spoke earlier in the program about business unionism, but I wonder if you could give us a sense of the degree to which the official union hierarchy resisted the kind of militancy and rank and file action that were the hallmark of this period.
Well, in the extreme, in a well-known example, and it is the extreme, Jock Yablonski, who challenged the Lewis and then Tony Boyle regime in the miners' union, Jock Yablonski was shot to death with his wife and daughter in their beds as a result of his challenge to that leadership. In Detroit, I think it was 1973, the UAW responded to a wildcat strike by mobilizing 1,000 staff and loyalists, many of them armed, to break a strike at, I think it was the Mack Avenue plant. The first person I know who was a delegate to a rank and file delegate to a Teamsters convention was savagely beaten for his efforts. So there wasn't the kind of violence that took place in the 1930s or 1919, but certainly there was violent opposition to the challenges to the trade union leadership. And dissent was not really something that was welcomed in the unions, and it could be quite dangerous to be a dissenter in the unions. What I think, one point I'd like to make, which I think is interesting, where in a movement which is a little different than some of the rest of the labor movement, but in the National Education Association, where the leadership was not repressive, where the leadership of the union was sympathetic to a grassroots organizing effort, where the leadership of the union was not, like the American Federation of Teachers, embroiled in battles with black militants. In the NEA, a grassroots movement lasted through the 70s and thousands of strikes, as I said earlier, and a million new workers came into the labor movement, teachers. And of course, many of these teachers were people who'd been in university in the 1960s. Public workers, looking at the other side of the picture, the similar leadership, not a revolutionary leadership, but a leadership which wanted to grow. The public workers, the city workers, state workers, that section of the working class was unionized and remained. Both of them remain to this day really the bulwarks of what's left of American unionism in the country. And of course, city workers that brought in, you know, millions of women workers and of black workers and the, you know, people who do the work of the cities and the state. So there's that contrast, I guess. The American labor movement in the 1950s became conservative. In the 1960s, its leaders were not sympathetic to the movements and issues of the time. They were not sympathetic. You know, people like Walter Reuther in the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, he felt that he was in the leadership of the anti-racist movement in many ways, despite virtual segregation within his the plants that he was that the union organized. And I mentioned Meany before, a total hawk on the issue of the war. Most of the labor leaders were totally pro-war, even though, and sometimes it's just staggering to think about how out of touch they were as a kind of strata of people, even though every single poll showed that blue-collar workers were far more likely to oppose the war in Vietnam than college-educated middle-class people were, for example. And so the labor leadership, then you think they're pro-war. You know, they're against black power. They're against affirmative action. They really find themselves separate and in conflict with these basic movements.
Well, I want to ask you, Cal Winslow, why these broader movements came to an end, why you trace this to 1981, which, of course, was the year of the mass firing of the air traffic controllers, the PATCO workers who Ronald Reagan ordered fired when they went on strike. Why did this spell the end of what you and Robert Brenner and Aaron Brenner termed the long 1970s?
Well, there's an interesting comparison with European unions, where the unions themselves grew, became more powerful, more influential in places like Britain and France and Italy as a result of the Paris Spring, the great general strike, the metal workers' strikes in northern Italy in 1969, the strike in Britain, which brought down the Tory government in 1972, and unionism itself expanded. Outside of the public sector, unionism didn't expand in the 1960s. The majority of workers remained unorganized in the United States, and so we don't call the decade the decade of the unions, but we call it the decade of the rank and file. I think that our analysis is that to a degree, the rank and file upsurge in the late 1970s was exhausted. If you just look at the miners' strike, this is a great stalemate of the national miners' strike, 110 days on strike, the people killed in 1978. You can understand what this group of workers has been through going on a decade. So I think there was a sense of exhaustion there. But the organized labor movement was still intact. There were still 20 million trade union members in the United States in 1980 when Reagan came into power. But I think that when the labor movement surrendered in the face of Reagan's attack on the air traffic controllers, that basically signaled that the path had been cleared for the neoliberal project of union removal, and the 1980s saw attack after attack on major unionized establishments, corporations. Concessions, which had really begun in auto in the 70s, became the law of the period, and the retreat really was unchecked. So I think we really see in 1981 the tables are turned, and there's an offensive that's begun against the working class as a whole and the trade union movement, which really continues to this day.
But let us not forget the thing that has kept the working class divided throughout U.S. history, and that has kept that caused these workers to vote against their interest, to act against their own interest, race. By the time of Reagan, if you read the check the Greenberg study of Detroit, of the Reagan Democrats in Detroit, they quote the Reagan Democrats in Detroit saying that blacks were responsible for everything that has gone wrong in their life. And don't forget that Reagan started his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, so he knew, and the Republicans knew, that the Southern strategy, well, they've been working on the strategy consistent. And it upholds to today. You can never downplay a myth, race as a key factor in keeping the working class divided.
Indeed. Mike Hamlin, I want to ask you the final question, which is, why do you think that this history that you, of course, played a role in the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers played an important role in this history of working class militancy in the 1960s and the 1970s seems to have been lost. Do you think that the fact that so many of the histories of the 1960s focus on the New Left and the student movement in particular might be part of the reason why people know less about all of these pretty phenomenal actions that took place amongst the working class during this time?
I think so. But I believe that the working class has still has that potential. But the system suppresses things that threats. And the notion that workers in this country could be organized class-wise, it's always been a dangerous idea. You know, going back to, the Paris Commune.
Mike Hamlin, Cal Winslow, I want to thank you so much, both of you, for joining me.
Thank you. I'm delighted.
And Mike Hamlin is one of the founders of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers that organized in Detroit. He has been a social worker for 35 years working with UAW Ford employees. And Cal Winslow is co-editor with Robert Brenner and Aaron Brenner of Rebel Rank and File, Labor Militancy and Revolt from Below During the Long 1970s. That book is out from Verso, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He is the director of the Mendocino Institute and fellow in environmental history at UC Berkeley. Against...